All right.
It's been a little while since I've been up here. We're going to start out on John 14, if you want to turn there. There's a saying somebody said, I don't know who it was. Somebody said that some people are so heavenly minded that they're earthly useless. I'm going to disprove some of that tonight, okay? In fact, there's a person that says it's just the opposite. Let's pray. Father, I pray for these few minutes. I pray for the new members class that pastor will be clear and helpful and help them to understand what it is to commit to being a church member. Father, I pray for the few words that I'm going to speak tonight that I can be clear and concise and understandable. And I pray that that I could say something that was worthy of remembrance. Lord, I pray that you'd bless this time. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. John chapter 14. It's a great chapter. We know that. Jesus made a statement that in John 14, 6, that he was the only way to get to heaven. And basically slamming the door on every other way into heaven. So, a great statement. But we're going to start at the top of the chapter. In verse 1 it says, "Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also." All right? So, what's going on is Jesus, the setting is the Passover. All right? And actually, if you want to turn back a chapter, go to John 13, which is also part of the Passover. It starts off with Jesus washing the disciples' feet. We all know what that was about. Basically, he's telling them, if I'm the creator and I can kneel down in front of you and wash your feet, there should be nothing that you shouldn't want to do. Right? And that's how he starts it off. If you notice, it's an interesting statement in verse 1 of chapter 13. Jesus says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own, which are in the world, he loved them to the end." Okay? So it's this Passover. Within hours, Jesus is going to be betrayed. He's going to go through a series of trials, mock trials. He's going to be on the cross the next day, and by this time tomorrow, he's going to be in the grave. It's a very troubling evening. You know, but it's interesting when he makes that statement in chapter 13, verse 1. All of eternity past and all of the history in the Old Testament was coming to this moment, to this day. This was the peak, so to speak, of human history, is this moment in time. And Jesus said, this is the hour. He knew that his hour had come. But it also, he also says in that same verse that he loved his disciples. He loved them all the way to the end. And so, now with that sitting that we're in the Passover, if you go on down chapter 13, he tells them that one of you is going to betray me. So he's telling the disciples, one of you is going to betray me. And so if you read in the other Gospels, they start saying, well, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? I mean, that's kind of shocking news that one of them, who they've lived with for 3.5 years, is Jesus says, you're going to betray me. But he does that. It turns out, we know it turns out to be Judas. And he keeps going in that chapter. And Jesus tells them, I'm going to go away. And where I'm going, you can't come for now, but you will come later. All right? That's verse 36. And then Peter, you know, famously says, Lord, where can you go that we can't? I will die for you, Lord. And then Jesus tells him, before the night is over, you're going to deny me three times. So he's told him somebody's going to betray him. He's told him he's going away and they can't come. And he's told Peter, you're going to deny me three times. So that's kind of the setting of where we're at in this Passover. And, you know, after Jesus has kind of told you all that, you're thinking, wow, what are these guys thinking? You know, what would you be thinking if you were them and Jesus said, I'm going to go away. You've lived with him, literally, for 3.5 years. You've watched him do all kinds of miracles. He walked on the water. He stopped the storm. He fed thousands and thousands with just a little food in a basket. He healed thousands and thousands of people. He touched the lepers, which was a no-no. Under Jewish law, you can't touch them. They're supposed to say unclean, unclean, right? You can't touch them. But Jesus touched them. He's healed people. He brought three people back from the dead. They've seen him do all this stuff. He sent them out, and they did a lot of this stuff too. They healed people, and they cast out demons, just like he did. And they came back, and they were, wow, we were able to heal people and cast out demons. They were excited. And now Jesus said, I'm going away. And you can't come. So, in verse 1, he says, let not your heart be troubled. If this was us, we'd be saying, read the room, right? Read the room. He can see. He's God. He knows what they're thinking. They're anxious. They're maybe a little scared. It's just like they're confused. They don't know what's going on. And, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, we don't understand. What's happening? So he starts out and he says, you believe in God the Father, right? You believe in God. Believe in me. After everything that you've seen me do, believe in me. Verse 2, he says, in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. I mean, Jesus is not lying to him. He's not trying to deceive him. And he flat out says, if it wasn't so, I would have told you. But I am going to prepare a place for you. Jesus himself is preparing a place for you. Preparing a place for you. It's the biggest construction project ever. Maybe outside of creation. But God the Father is allowing Jesus to prepare us a place in his abode, heaven, for us to live. Heaven is a real place. It is a real geographical location. It exists somewhere. We can't see it now. We don't know where it's at, but it is a real place. The word place there for heaven is a real place is the word topos, which is the root word for topography. You know what topography is, right? It's a map. It shows the trees, the mountains, and forests, and stuff like that. That's the root word for topography is topos, meaning it's a real place. It is the exact location. And so the best thing about this place, though, it's going to be uniquely yours. Uniquely yours. Nobody else's place is going to be like your place. Jesus isn't going to use a cookie cutter type of construction to build our places. You know, you go out to some additions and they got like 5 model homes. So they're going to build 100 houses, but you got to pick which one of these model homes you like the best and find a house that looks like it. There's 100 houses, but There's only five different types. That's not how Jesus is building your place. He's not using a cookie-cutter approach. It's going to be uniquely yours. He describes it as a mansion. He could have used house. You think Jesus didn't know what a house was? Huh? He could have. That word for mansion means, in the original language, is money. It means a residence or a boat or a mansion. See, Paul, when he's kind of telling us about what heaven's going to be like, he's actually quoting Isaiah. So we know that as Paul is saying, every time Paul says, as it is written, he's referring to the Old Testament. Because remember, they didn't have the New Testament. He's writing the New Testament now. So he's quoting Isaiah 64:4 when he says, for since the beginning of the world, men have not heard nor perceived by the ear, nor hath the eye seen, O God, beside thee, what he hath prepared for him that waited for him. I'm not that familiar. We're more familiar with 1 Corinthians 2:9 when Paul says, but it, as it is written, the eye hath not seen, nor the ear heard, neither hath entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. So Paul is telling us that the absolute best that we can imagine, we're not even touching how great it is. That our place is going to be like. You know, for Gail, you know, she likes butterflies. I have an office. So no butterflies allowed. She's got the rest of the house. She likes butterflies and lighthouses. All right? When I'm thinking of her place, I'm thinking, you know, God's going to decorate it with butterflies. They could be real butterflies and just, you know, come in and land and then they'll rearrange themselves or something. Or, you know, it's, I don't know why they think lighthouses, but maybe. You don't know. But that's kind of what I'm thinking. But it's going to be uniquely hers. And so I guess the big question for me is, and maybe, you know, you could think the big question for you too, is do you want your place right next to his place? Don't answer that. Don't answer that. But even if it was, you're not really going to be that close to him. I'll explain that in a second. But it was just a thought. You want to be next door neighbors for eternity? I wonder if we'll be able to move if we don't like it. But it's uniquely made for us. How can we not like it? Anyway, but Jesus said, I'm going to make it for you. I am making a mansion for you. Uniquely yours. C.S. Lewis said, listen to what he says. It's kind of interesting. He says, your place in heaven will seem to be made for you and you alone, because you were made for it. Made for it, stitch by stitch, as a glove is made for your hand. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? Your place is going to be uniquely yours because you were made for it. Now we know, because God knows everything, that from eternity past, before he made creation, he knew that I was going to get saved. He knew that he was going to be making me a mansion. He knows my personality. He knows everything about me. He knows what I like, what I don't like. The things that I maybe want to put on the wall, he's not going to. I have my discharge from the military, which is, means nothing. I have a certification for some different things that those don't mean anything. And that's what I have on my walls. I have my, when I graduated from college, I was a summa cum laude, so I got a special award for that stuff. And not going to mean anything. So that won't be in my mansion. So But you can imagine what it's going to be like. So kind of intro there. Can get back to the point of what is Jesus doing now? First, he's trying to reassure them because of all the things that he said. He said, I'm going away, right? I'm going away. They devoted the last 3.5 years to him. And now he says, I'm going to go away and you can't come with me. The second thing he's trying to do, and you know, when I was looking at verse 1 and verse 2, I said, why would he say that? Why would he tell them, I'm going to go away and I'm going to build a mansion for you? Why would he tell them that when he's trying to reassure them? Because maybe he knows that they're scared. He knows that they're uncertain. He knows that they don't understand everything that's going on. But he's trying to get them maybe to think about heaven. Think about heaven. Think about the after. Think about it. He's trying maybe to get them to focus on heaven and what it's going to be like. I'm going to go prepare a place for you. I'm not abandoning you. I'm going away. I'm just saying goodbye or so long. I'm not saying goodbye forever. And I did, you know, he did say, I'm going. You cannot go, but you will come afterwards. He told him that. You're going to come afterwards. They still don't understand it, but he didn't say, I'm going to abandon you. So he's trying maybe to get them to focus on heaven. Not trying to distract them. Just trying to get them to focus a little bit on heaven. See, there was some... when he was talking to them about going away, if you read in the Bible, Jesus told them multiple times that I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be put on trial, I'm going to be killed, and after I'm killed, I'm going to rise again the third day. Every single time he told them he was going to be killed, he told them, I'm going to rise again. I'm going to rise on the third day. All right? Matthew 16:21 says, and Jesus told them from this time forth to show them to his disciples, he must go unto them in Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed and raised again the third day. And if you look... if I where I put that. In Matthew 17:21, that was 16:21, Matthew 17:21, he said that. In Matthew 20:17, he also said that. So just in those four chapters, he told them three times, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to rise again. But see, the disciples never understood what he was talking about. They didn't get the resurrection. They didn't get it. That is not in their Jewish training for who the Messiah was. That's not who the Messiah is. Well, I'll prove it to you. In Mark 9:10, it says, and they kept that saying with themselves, questioning one another what the rising from the dead should mean. They're talking amongst themselves. What does it mean when he says rise from the dead? What does that mean? What does it mean? They don't know. In verse 31 and 32, it says, for he taught his disciples and said unto them, the Son of Man is delivered unto the hands of men, and they shall kill him, and after that he is killed, he shall rise the third day. Look at verse 32. But they understood not the saying, and were afraid to ask him. They did not get or understand the resurrection until after it was all over. Until they were on the other side of it. Until he presented themselves. You know, even Thomas said, they were telling him, they saw the risen Jesus. He said, I'm not going to believe it until I can put my hand through the holes, right? They didn't believe it. They didn't believe it. They just couldn't work it out. Now, their idea of a Messiah, we get, you know, we can understand from Acts chapter 1, verse 6, where when they're talking to him, they said, when therefore they were come together, they asked him, saying, Lord, Will thou at this time restore the kingdom unto Israel? That's their idea of a Messiah. He's going to be a conquering king. He's going to kick the Romans out, and he's going to restore the kingdom to them. That's their idea of who the Messiah is. It's not this. What's going on here is not their idea of a Messiah. They're all messed up with all the Jewish training and teaching and stuff like that, and they just never got it. What they didn't see was, if you look back through history, you got Jesus' first coming and you got his second coming, but in between is a valley called the church age, and they couldn't see the valley. In Revelation 19, Jesus is going to come back. He's going to be conquering. He's going to, you know, destroy the enemies of God. He's going to set up a kingdom where he's going to rule and reign on the earth for 1,000 years. Right? But they couldn't see what's going on right now. It was like, what does he mean? What does he mean? I don't understand. What does he mean? They never got it. They never got it. So, again, he's trying to reassure them. So why should we focus on heaven? Why should we focus on heaven? Focusing on heaven reminds us of the brevity of our earthly life. What did it say in James 4:14? Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Right? You've been out in the cold, you see your breath, you breathe it out, you see the fog, and then it's gone. That's what James is saying. He's saying, that's your life. You live to be 80, 90, 100 years old. What is that in comparison to the age of the earth? You know, 6,000 years. What is that compared to eternity? It's not even a drop in the ocean. It's not even a drop in the ocean. It is so minuscule. Our life is brief. It seems a long time to us, but, you know, I'll be 69 next month. Boom, my life is gone. I can remember being 6 years old, playing with other kids, you know, right before my birthday. I was telling them, I'm seven. You know, when you're six, you want to be seven. I can remember that. I can remember holding my sons after they were born in my arms. You know, my youngest son just turned 40 this month. It goes quick. It goes quick. Life is brief. Teaches us about the inevitability of death. There's only one way off the planet, folks. As Elkridge Boyce said, you don't have to go to heaven, but you can't stay here. All right? In Ecclesiastes 9:2, it says, all things alike come to all. There's one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean, to the unclean, and to him that sacrifices, and to him that sacrifices not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth is to he that feareth an oath. Verse 3, there is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event to all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil and madness, is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. It is inevitable. Everybody's going to die. Three people a second. Boom. Three people every second. 180 a minute. Go on. I've been talking here, not quite 30 minutes. That's what, 5,400? 10,800 an hour, 260,000 a day. Boom, gone. Into eternity. They're breaking through eternity. They're just going and going and going and going and going. That should put some urgency on us to tell people, hey, there's a heaven. There's a hell. You need to make a reservation if you're going to heaven. There's one fate. There's two destinations. You've got to make a reservation. The reason for death. Romans 3:23. All have sinned. Right? Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death. We're all sinners. This world is filled with sin. It's a nasty, unclean, vicious, mean world. Full of sin. It's on the billboards. It's on the TVs. It's on the phones. You can just be standing somewhere and people will start cussing. They don't even have respect for your children anymore. It's just a nasty world out there. It's full of sin. Everybody's a sinner. Or obviously God would be a liar then, right? The terror of death. What is this? The terror of death. Job 18:14. His confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle, and it shall bring him to the king of terrors. Job called it the king of terrors. The psalmist says in 55:4, my heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Well, what are the terrors of death? I mean, come on, guys. We're going to heaven. How come we're not out jumping off the roof? How come we're not playing on a freeway? Standing in front of trains. We're going to heaven. Because God has put in each one of us a desire to live. He put us on this earth to live. That's what we're here for. That's why we were born. That's why God made the earth. It's for man to live on the earth. He made it for man. Now, I'll admit, I'm not looking to die. I'd rather just, you know, fall asleep and just not wake up. That'd probably be the best way to go. You just need to check. Gail put a bunch of wet cloths on my face like they did to that one king. But I don't want to be... Discovery has some shows about sharks. I watch them. I don't want to get in the water. If you don't get in the water, you know, you can't be eaten by a shark, right? If you don't get on train tracks, you won't be hit by a train, right? You have to go to the train tracks to be hit by the train. It's not going to jump the tracks, you know, and come downtown and hit you. But I'm not going to be swimming with sharks. I wanted to, you know, in the new world, in the new life, after, you know, got my new body. I want to go swimming with the sharks because I'll just hold on to the fin, let me drag him around, but there's not going to be any oceans. We'll talk about that in a minute. I'm going to kind of miss out on that. But anyway, I'm sure God's got something better for me. Focusing on heaven prepares us for the certainty of judgment. Every single one of us, saved or unsaved, is going to stand in front of God. The bema seat of the great white throne. You stand in front of the bema seat, you can be judged for what you did after you were saved, right? For your rewards. And when Paul talks about that, he talks about knowing the terror of the Lord. He's talking to Christians there. Knowing the terror of the Lord. It's not going to be a good thing, I guarantee you. It's not going to be a good thing when we stand in front of the Lord. Because we probably have blood on our hands that maybe we don't even know about. I mean, I know from a couple of instances there's some blood on my hands. But it's we're all going to be judged. It's coming. Jesus talks about it in Matthew 7, 13 and 14. It's interesting that he talks about hell first. Wide is the gate, broad is the path that leads to destruction. Many there be that go in there. And narrow, straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leads to life. And few there be that find it. One fate, two destinations. And it tells us, it also says that there's gates. There's gates there. You're not going to wander into the wrong one by accident. Okay? There's a gate. It's blocking people from getting in and out. It's locked up. You're not going to accidentally wander into it. But it's interesting that Jesus said, he could have said there's a broad path, but he said, a wide gate and a broad path, or a broad gate and a wide path. So there's gates. It's a choice, right? Focusing on heaven motivates us to pure lives. In 2 Peter 3, I won't read verse 10, but verse 11, verse 10 basically is telling us that he's going to burn the earth up. It's going to burn. All right, verse 11 says, "Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conversation and godliness?" I mean, seriously, if we think rapture is imminent, which you look around this world, communication is all over the world at once. The gospel is being preached all over the world. Those are, you know, to the requirements for him coming back, not the rapture, him coming back. The digital IDs, right, that we've, pastors talked about, some of the countries are pure digital now. That's coming. That means the rapture is just, I mean, the clock has got to be like 11:59. We got to be close. So if we think that Jesus is knocking on the door, shouldn't that motivate us to live pure lives, or as pure as possible, right? Keep short accounts with God, as Brother Wallace used to say. Here's something. Focusing on heaven places suffering in perspective. A lot of people in here, well, I don't know about in here right now, but I know some people in here have had cancer. Okay? I had it. When the doctor comes back and says, "You have cancer," when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, you got cancer. You died. You did. I can remember my parents telling me that somebody had cancer, and then, you know, a few weeks later, they were dead. I connected death and cancer. And when I was told I had cancer, I knew five guys that had the same cancer I did, and they're still alive. One of them was my dad, and the other one was my brother. So I walked around for like 2 weeks. I was scared. I was thinking I was going to die or something. You know, it's like, what? You know, what am I doing? You know, but you know, the fact that you have cancer, it kind of sets you up. But the point is that we have to keep it in perspective. Again, our lives are short down here. We have short lives. When compared to eternity, these lives are short. No matter how much suffering we go through, it is nothing compared to eternity. It just isn't. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4:17, "For our light affliction is but for a moment, worketh for us a more exceeding and eternal weight in glory." Basically, for the Christians, if you can muddle through this sin-filled, nasty world, this is as worse as it's going to be. This is it. This is the worst. If you can muddle through this world, this is the worst that it's going to be. It only gets better. So no matter how bad it is, if you can get through it, this is the worst. That it's going to be. It's momentary. I've lived 69 years. I have not been suffering for the entire 69 years. Okay? I've suffered through some things. I seem to think I've had a relatively good life. I don't take a lot of credit for that. I give that to God, because I keep trying to imagine what my life would be like without God. But I'm thinking that because I've known God, I've had a relatively good life. So, but even if it's suffering, it's momentary. Especially when you compare it to eternity. When we go to heaven, there's going to be blessings there. God has promised to bless us. He's promised to glorify us. He's going to build a mansion for us. We are joint heirs with Jesus Christ. We're joint heirs with Jesus Christ. So everything that God is going to do for Jesus Christ, He's going to do for us. You know why we are being conformed to the image of Jesus Christ? Because when we all go to heaven, God's going to see like 2 billion little Jesus Christ running around. And He's going to bless us. He's going to bless us for all eternity. I don't know. There we go. Our suffering is light. Paul said it in that verse, verse 17. It's light. Compared to eternity, it's light. When I had my cancer surgery, there was some post-op stuff that I had to endure, which was not pleasant. And I hadn't endured it for a while. There were some days I didn't handle it well. I was angry. God, why did you let me get cancer? I was angry. Things sometimes got messy. It made me angrier. What happened? I lost my perspective. I got it back, but just there was moments that I had lost my perspective. Paul talks about the weight of glory. That word weight there, that means load. It means abundance. It means burdensome. Okay? It means like that glory is going to be so heavy that, you know, it's like we're going to be carrying it around. We're going to be hunched over because of the load. That's what he's talking about. It's going to be an abundant, weighty glory. And that's what God has in store for us. In verse 3, Jesus said, "If I'm preparing a place for you, I will come back and take you there." Right? Right? He says, if I'm preparing a place for you, I'm going to come back and get you. So, where's heaven? Where's he going to take us to? Where is it? Heaven is up. It's up. I'll prove it to you. Acts, again, chapter 1, verse 9. And when he had spoken these things, they beheld while he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, they were looking up. As he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, which also said, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand you gazing into heaven?" They were going, wow, that was incredible. You know, Christ just floated away and the clouds just, wow. So they said, "Why are you standing here gazing up? This same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven." Right? So it's up. And Isaiah 14, that's the Lucifer. He's got his five I wills in there. Remember that? One of them is verse 13. It says, "I will ascend into heaven." So heaven is up. I think it's north. That's just me. I mean, according to Isaiah 14, again, Lucifer is saying, "I will also sit upon the mount of the congregation, sides of the north." Job in 37:22 also talks about the north. Now, can I prove that it's north? I think if this is the globe, you know, the United States is kind of right there. So if I point up, I'm actually pointing out that way. All right? I think heaven is If I had to place it, I think it's somewhere up here in the north, okay? I can't prove that. Obviously, I don't know where it's at. I'm not any smarter than anybody else in here, but that's where I think it is. So what about the present heaven versus the future heaven? All right. Well, the first heaven is the Earth's atmosphere. If you've flown in a plane, you've flown through the heaven, the first heaven, right? Some people have actually made it into the second heaven, which is called outer space. And then Paul said he was caught up to the third heaven, which we know is the abode of God, right? That's called the third heaven. Again, we don't know exactly where it's at. It's in the spiritual realm anyway. So even if it was sitting on top of the earth, we wouldn't be able to see it because it's in the spiritual world. We're not. But in Revelation 21, when the Apostle Paul is reciting the words that Jesus gave him to write down, he talks, and there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth, right? It's going to be new, brand new. This world, as we know, it's going to be burned up. So the new car that you just bought, it's gone. All the money you have in your bank account, it's gone. I mean, what is that money worth anyway? God paves his streets with gold. So he doesn't need our money. He doesn't need our money now, but he allows us to participate. That's what it's for. But it's going to be new. It's going to be a physical location. All right? This city is going to be a physical location. All right, it's described in the Bible as being 660 feet, which is a furlong. Right? 660 feet is a furlong. 12,000 times 12,000 furlongs is how it's described, right? So that's 7,920 feet. Divide that by 5,280, which is how many feet are in a mile, 1,500 miles. So it's 15 by 1,500 by 1,500. Right? Again, I told you it's the biggest construction project ever. So that's 1,500 by 1,500 by 1,500 is 3,375,000 cubic miles. That's a lot. How would you want to be on the penthouse for that one? You know how high up you are? There's 660,000 stories based on the normal height stories. Anybody know what the tallest skyscraper is on the planet today? Yeah, it's in Dubai, 162 stories, which is pretty tall. But it's not 660,000 stories. It's 2,250,000 square miles. 2,250,000 square miles, you know, the base of it. It's basically from New York City to Dallas. To put that in perspective, the state of Texas is 268,596 square miles. So it's what, one-tenth the size of what the new city is going to be. There's going to be enough room for 20 billion residents. Each resident could have 75 acres. 75 acres. So that's an acre is 200 feet by 200 feet or 8.7 square miles. So if you put your house right in the middle of your property and he put his right in the middle of his, you'd still be like 9 miles apart. So it will be familiar. Okay? We'll recognize it for what it is. Right? There won't be any oceans on the new earth, which is kind of a, like I said, I don't get to swim with the sharks, unless they're land sharks, but I doubt that. But there's not going to be any sun or moon. The Bible says it's not going to be sun or moon because the glory of God is going to be the light that shines. There's not going to be any nighttime. We're not going to need to sleep. I mean, if you don't like to eat, you don't have to eat anymore. Right? You can't die. You don't have to worry about your weight. You can eat all the chocolate you want. The best part about it, I think, is it's going to be free from sin. That's going to be probably the best part. It's going to be free from sin. No sin ever again. No more sin. No temptation. Nothing. Habakkuk 2:14 says, "The earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord." You can, Peggy will be able to play with the snake or spiders. They won't bite her. I don't know if she ever will or not. She might warm up to them eventually, but you know, they're not going to harm her, right? It says the snake and the little child are going to play together, right? Lions and tigers and oxen are going to feed together. The lions are going to eat grass, right? That's what it says. The Bible says the lions will eat grass. The new capital is going to be the new Jerusalem, which is obviously going to come down from heaven. And there's not going to be a temple. Why would we need a temple? You know, I got a picture of Holland on my phone. I like to look at her. They just went to Six Flags. And they rode that big Texas Giant thing. And they took one picture of it before. She's going. And then they took a picture of it after. She's going. I made the mistake of laughing and giggles. Why are you laughing at that? Because it's, and I just walked away. I didn't have a good answer. But yeah, I have a picture of Holland. But you know what? It's not as good as the real thing. Having Holland there is better than having a picture of her. Having Jesus here on the earth living with us, we don't need a temple. We can go right to Jesus and worship him. You know, it's always from the beginning of creation, God has always wanted to live among his people. All right? I'm going to wind up here. God's always wanted to live with his people. And you see those verses there, that there's lots and lots and lots of verses where God has promised to live with his people. He was always wanted in the Garden of Eden. What did he do every day at the cool of the day? He came down and walked on the earth, right? Fellowship with Adam. That's what he wanted. That's what he set it up for. That's what he wants to do. He wants to live with us. I mean, there was a reason he created us. He created us for fellowship. And I'll close with this. C.S. Lewis, and that original statement I made at the very front of this, it says, "The problem with most Christians is not that they think too much about heaven, but they think too little about it. If you read history, you will find that the Christians who did the most for the present world were precisely those who thought the most of the next world. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this world. Aim at heaven, and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at the earth, and you'll get neither." So, that's part of the reason that I think that first statement is not necessarily true. I mean, it may apply to some people, but as a rule, if we were more heavenly minded, knowing that people are dying every day and going to hell, we'd be more serious about what we do here. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for this time together, Lord. I pray that, Lord, that I've said something that will cause people to think and to think about heaven. Think about what the things that you've said and you've done for them. Father, I pray that you take us away with your blessing. I ask these things in Jesus' name.